Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hardcore Finance Podcast with Alex and Shimon. Today, we have a very special guest, Daniel Prince from the Once Bitten Podcast. It's one of my favorite Bitcoin podcasts. So, hey, Daniel, how are you?
Hey, Shimon. Thank you for inviting me on. And hi, Alex. Nice to meet you guys.
Yeah, it's really, really nice to meet you. We have somewhat of a similar background. So Alex and I are recovering strategy consultants, and I really loved your kind of banking experiences that you shared in some previous episodes. So do you mind sharing with our audience how what was going through your mind when you were working in banking, and then how did you discover Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. I wonder what episode you listened to. Was it the one with John Vallis and Andy Edstrom by any chance?
Yeah, I think it was the one with Andy Edstrom because he also had a Goldman Sachs background or something, right?
Yeah. Was it the one where I almost crashed the cars on my second day? Were you listening to that one?
I don't remember exactly about
it. Okay, then you got a treat coming your way. There's an episode if you look through, I can't remember which number episode it is, but if you look through the list on the Once Bitten website or wherever you stream them from, find the episode with Andrew Edstrom and John Vallis, because the three of us used to work in the financial world. John was in wealth management in Shanghai. Andy was Goldman in New York, and I worked for foreign exchange brokerages based out of London or Singapore. The bulk of my career was spent in Singapore for 15 years, but we start talking and sharing old stories from that world, and I share a story about my first or second day at work. Well, first day at work was when I was first given the keys to the Bentley to go and park, but the second day was when I almost crashed it. So spoiler alert, yes. But...
I remember that one.
Right. Okay. So how did I end up?
It's crazy if they gave you their Bentley like as an intern.
Yeah.
Like.
I was parking.
We give Bentleys out to all of our podcast guests, by the way.
Oh, well, that's.
So you'll have another one after the.
British Racing Green, if you guys would be so kind.
Yeah, when Bitcoin hits like a million.
Right.
We can figure something out.
I'll give you guys a call and let you know that I'm still waiting on that Bentley delivery. But yeah, how did I find myself in that world? For me, I left 1995 is when I left my what we call in the UK our A-level education. So we have GCSE, and then we have A-level, and then you go to university and you study for your degree or your PhD or your master's, whatever, however long you're staying for. I left after A-levels because I was just sick and tired of the education system and academia at large. And my father worked in London, and all of his peers and colleagues and network was in the financial foreign exchange markets, because that was the job that he had been doing at that stage for around 30 years. So invariably, one of these guys end up sacking the poor 18 to 19 year old kid that comes back with a cold coffee, and somebody else gets roped in. So that was my door into the big wide world of finance. It's not a glory path by any stretch of the imagination. And then I had to endure for the next 2 or 3 years doing exactly that. Getting coffees, sandwiches, breakfasts, lunches for up to like 16 guys on the dollar mark A desk, which was the biggest market, US dollar against the German Deutschmark. This is how far back we're going, guys. We didn't even have the euro. But then if the B desk, if their trainee was out, then you had another 10 to 12 guys in there. So sometimes you were just getting sent down to get like 25 breakfasts all in one go from like 6 or 7 different shops, because everybody had their favorite, you know, sandwich or beans on toast, as they love to eat in the UK. And then do the same for lunches, then do the same for afternoon snacks, and then do the same for coffee shops all day long. My goodness, when lottery tickets became a thing, like scratch card lottery tickets. These guys, inherent gamblers. So you just be down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And you're just thinking, one day I'll get a seat at the table. One day I'll get to pick up a phone and start talking to some customers. And it's a test. It's they do this purposely. I look back on it with kind of fond memories. It was great. It was very character building. You were around some extreme characters, which for the mm-hmm. most part were funny, but sometimes were just, you know, pretty bad, to say the very least. And then, yeah, I just worked my way up in that market. Actually, that market, the door slammed shut on everybody because they invented something, well, some entrepreneur invented something called EBS, Electronic Broking System, which basically took everybody's jobs. So spot foreign exchange, voice brokerage was killed almost overnight by that intervention. So I had to go and find myself a different mm-hmm. seat and start all over again. And there I managed to find, because I knew all the other runners on all the other desks, because we would always be out sharing information about, you know, where's the, oh, there's a new coffee shop over here and this is cheaper over there and blah, you know, you had your own little network going. And as I was fired from the spot desk, I walked down to go and I got fired and then took coffee orders for everyone. It was brilliant. Because I said to the guys, right, okay, you know, what's the notice? It's, well, 2 weeks. So, well, do you mind if I work that 2 weeks and then just use this 2 weeks to go and ask every other desk head if they need some help, and I'll just go and be a trainee on their desk? And they were like, yeah, okay, sure. We need 6 coffees. So, okay, down I go, and I speak to nice. speak to the guy on the foreign exchange options desk. And that was in a different building. But I knew him really well, and he said, oh yeah, one of our board boys has just, he's just been given the sack. So we need someone. I'll speak to my manager. And I saw him the next day. This was before we didn't even have email addresses. We didn't even have mobile phones. So I saw him the next day on the sandwich run, and he's like, oh yeah, I spoke to my man. He said, come up and have a chat. So I did, and was hired on the spot and changed desks. And, yeah, the rest is history. I spent the next 16 or so years on that product, but moved across to Singapore in 1999.
Wow, yeah, those are some crazy intern stories. I remember for me, I didn't spend too much time at BCG. I basically was there less than a year because I really didn't like the lifestyle.
Right.
But I remember as an intern, I got assigned to go to different grocery stores and write down the expiration dates on salad dressings to solve like a really, really complex logistical problem of like a top salad dressing manufacturer that takes too long for the stuff to reach the shelves of grocery stores. And so they were like, look, they will kick you out at some point because it's illegal to like just write this down. But if they kick you out from one grocery store, just go to another. And so I had to go to like 3 or 4 grocery stores, and every time they would kick me out. Oh my God. It's those things. They're so like, it's so weird. Like the industry has this idiosyncratic, right, things that they expect from you. And, but it somehow works.
Yeah. It's crazy. So what were you doing? Were you doing equity analysis?
So this was an operational case for basically to see why it's taking them too long to get the salad dressing to shelves in the stores. But yeah, it was part of a larger, the way strategy consulting works is they take a big problem and break it down into small chunks. Mm-hmm. So for example, the problem could be like the equity is underperforming our competitors, right? And so then you break it down, right? Is it a cost issue? Is it a revenue issue? Is it like a operating cost? Is it, and then you assign different teams to look at different chunks of it. But like as an intern, you do the absolutely most boring and trivial part of the entire case.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know, those merger and acquisitions and the due diligence and the things, you know, like that, those, the amount of hours those guys work, I don't know how anybody lasts into their 30s or 40s doing that. It's incredible. Yes. How did I get into Bitcoin? Okay. So I've heard about it very early because just of the nature of my work. I worked in foreign exchange. So anything like this was always coming across our attention. And all of us, we just poo-pooed it. I don't think I'm still trying to convince my ex-colleagues and friends and network and peers from the foreign exchange days to take a closer look. Some have started to buy some just because I keep badgering them, but we all completely poo-pooed it. So I don't know, maybe this was 11 or 12. And then Mt. Gox went down and I thought that was the end of it. I remember seeing the front of the International Herald Tribune. I can see the picture clearly in my face. And I think the headline was like, we want our money back. And I was just like, you guys are idiots. Like, I honestly thought this was going to work. Like, magic internet money. I mean, of course, this was just a complete and utter disaster. And I actually thought that was just the end of Bitcoin. I didn't understand at all. I did not do any further research. And then it came back around to my attention in 2014, when I had met Grant Williams, who has a brilliant podcast called The End Game, one of them. He has a few. And he writes the things that make you go, blog. And he and I had got to know each other in Singapore, and he had just co-founded and launched Real Vision with Raoul Powell. And Grant and I, whenever we met, we would always just sit and just like talk about these markets are just that nothing makes sense. You know, we'd both been in the market through 08, seen 09, 010, excuse me, 2010, and then 11, and everything just keep going up and up and up. And obviously we understood quantitative easing was doing, you know, the talking here. But we it's like this has to roll over. They can't keep kicking the can down the road, surely. And guess what, guys? Here we are, 2021. They're still kicking that same can. But I asked him, because I'd signed up as an early participator in Real Vision, and I started watching the interviews, and I was blown away by the quality of the interviews. And I remember just saying offhandedly to Grant one night, are you guys ever going to do anything on Bitcoin and like this all of this crazy nonsense? Because apparently it's not dead, and I just don't understand too much about it. You know, why does it keep coming back? It's surely a joke. And he said, yeah, well, Princey, keep an eye out. In the next couple of weeks, we've got some interesting conversations that are going to be aired. And they aired them with Wences Cesarez and I've butchered his name, sorry, Tour de Mister. Trace Mayer, are the three that I distinctly remember. And I was like, oh my goodness, these aren't just internet geeks. Like, you know, Trace was a lawyer and was talking very eloquently about Bitcoin. And, you know, Wences was a businessman and was talking, laying out the case for Bitcoin for people in Argentina and how they had suffered after the peso being hyperinflated and devalued and how Bitcoin is an answer to this. So that the humanitarian aspect side of it was covered. And Tour was just Tour talking like, you know, really deep into economics and whatever else that he has the ability to talk about. So that set me on my way of trying to find more information about it. And then I found Andreas, like many of us did, watched his videos, saw his passion, understood his message, bought his books, and then started actually interacting with Bitcoin in the back end of 2015. And yeah, the rest has been, I would say actually, this is what I find different about people now. Yeah, sure. You could say I started learning about Bitcoin back in 2014 and been around, you know, interacting with it since 15, 16, 17. But I would not call myself a Bitcoiner up until about last year when I first started the podcast. But now what you see when people first hear about it, and they've bought it and they're a Bitcoiner within a week and they get it. And it's just amazing how quickly this is all suddenly moving now. It's like a rocket ride through the rabbit hole, rather than those of us that fell down it and hit every branch along the way and actually started trying to climb out of it sometimes. So it's really encouraging to see how quickly people are picking up on what this is and what this could mean for their future and for their family's future.
Yeah, I mean, the depth of information that exists now is just mind-blowing, right? It's like it's not just the quantity, but like the quality of things you can access as an entry-level person in Bitcoin is just, it's so amazing. And it's funny that you should mention the whole kicking the can down the road thing, because that's kind of my first thought process was about like Bitcoin. It didn't materialize back then, but I remember at BCG, they wrote this report called "How Long Can We Kick the Can Down the Road" about printing money. And it was kind of open-ended, right? So it wasn't like, yeah, we can only do this for 10 more years and then everything will collapse. It was kind of open-ended. And I asked the partner who wrote this, I was like, hey, you know, what is your personal thought? Like off the record, when do you think is the end game of all of this, like money printing, and when will inflation come? And he's like, look, I don't know what the end game is, but the secret to financial success in life is just leverage yourself as much as you can without getting a margin call, and you'll be fine. And so that was kind of it's so true, right? Because like people understand it, like people who are in the system, they understand it. And that's why, for example, in Israel, everybody buys real estate, right? Like real estate is the thing where you can just like leverage your money with the down payment. But yeah, that for me was a big, it's the first time that I noticed how much money was being printed. And until then, you know, and I had a financial education, had an MBA, took courses called Money Markets and the Fed, like, you know, like from people from the Federal Reserve. And nobody ever thought that it's a problem. Like, they just were watching inflation, like consumer inflation. And they're like, look, as long as we don't see inflation, it's not a problem. And nobody thinks through the implications of all of this money printing. So what do you think is the end game of this? So I've had several conversations and listened to many podcasts, like with Jeff Booth and some other, you mentioned Grant Williams, all of these guys, and everybody has a little bit of a different idea of like this inflation versus deflation thing. So for our listeners, the idea is like the government prints money, a lot of money every year, but then there's also some technological deflation that makes things cheaper. Like if government wouldn't print money, things would get cheaper and cheaper every year. So there's like this balancing act where, like, you know, you can maybe balance the two. And like if you have 8% expected deflation, maybe you can print 10% of money. And then you see 2%, you know, the difference between 8 and 10, that's what you see in consumer prices. But then the problem is that like rich people who own the assets, they get the benefit of the printed money and poor people just see the higher prices. So what do you think, how do you think this will play out over the next couple of decades?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what you pretty much described there was the price stability mandate that these central banks have and think they're playing God when they spout about this. And Parker wrote a great essay about it. I can't remember the exact title of that one, Parker Lewis's series. But yeah, so they get involved and they try and control markets when they needn't, because the free market should know best and we should all be able to make our own economic decisions on the price signals that we get from one another when we're trading with each other all day long in the marketplace. But because they have this price stability mandate, and if they see technology is deflating prices by X amount, and they figure that they can print just 2% above that X amount, then everyone's going to be fine and all things are going to be great. Whereas really what they're doing, as you referenced, like that just pushes asset prices up. It's called I'm in France, I should use the French pronunciation, I suppose, the Cantillon effect, which is, you know, those that are closest to the spigot of money will benefit the greatest. So what goes up? The stock market. Look at it. I mean, look at it since 2008, like since March 2009. I mean, we had Lehman go over in September 2008. Bear Stearns closely followed, didn't they? And then there was someone else bailed out. Then the big bailout started. Then TARP, I think, started hitting early 09. And you can look from when TARP started hitting the banks from about March 09, I'm pretty sure. I don't think the stock markets have gone down ever since. And look at the amount of money that's been pumped into the system since then. And why do they do it? Because each 4 years you have a president, especially in the US, because you know these are this that they drive the global markets. They have the reserve currency, and everybody is watching those stock markets very, very closely and investing into them, because that's where you're going to make the greatest and safest returns throughout history. So each president wants to come in and make sure the stock market does not go down on his watch. So what they're incentivized just to keep printing more and keep printing more. It's going to be the same. We're seeing it play out already, right? Biden's already come out and said, we're going to do this ridiculous stimulus in air quotes. And it's all for the good of the people, of course. It's all for the greater good. And we want to give you guys as much free money as possible and look after you as much as possible. All under the very safe knowledge that by doing this, stock markets are going to go up. The housing market's going to go crazy, and they can sit back in 9 months to a year and say, wow, what a great year that's been. First term of office, stock market's all-time highs, property market's great, the economy is this. There's a big unemployment number, but that was from the last term. If you look at it, it's probably pretty flat. We've managed to stave that off. And you'll see all these narratives start playing out, and they'll carry on doing the same. They don't know any different. They think they're doing the right thing for a great part. But all that's going to happen is people are going to get more and more just tired of this. This and waking up to it. This is what I feel normal people, the average Joe, whatever you want to call them, noobs, it doesn't matter. People are waking up, and it's shaking people to the core. Like, hang on a minute, to ask the questions, what actually is going on? Like, what is quantitative easing? What is printing? How do they print money? Why do they print money? Where does that money go? Who gets it first? And who are these bunch of loud-ass mavericks talking about Bitcoin all the time? And why is this now on the news? Why is this on the front page of the Financial Times? Why have MicroStrategy bought now? They just announced like today another $600 million is going to be going into Bitcoin. That would put them up to $1.5 billion. Why did Tesla and Elon Musk buy $1.5 billion? So this now is in the stage of it's going to speed up very, very quickly with people asking more and more questions about Bitcoin. What's the response? Now, yeah, how do I see it playing out? What's the end game? It's so hard to call because the game theory is so interesting. It's incredible that we're at this point now where companies are putting this on their balance sheets. That is so critically important because with that, come the lawyers, and with that come the lobbyists, and with that comes huge power, which Bitcoin has never had in the past. You know, it's always been guys, you know, defending themselves in the corner. I mean, look what happened to poor Hodlnaut, right? He was sued and followed and tracked down and doxxed. Now we have big business on the side of Bitcoin. It protects it at a layer we've never had protection before. So this just speeds everything up again and, you know, ossifies the network, that extra layer, and ossifies people's conviction, and will just bring in more attention. It will bring in more companies. It will bring in more individuals. And this is going to go very, very quickly. And people like, you know, how do they shut it down? Will they shut it down? Well, What can governments do now? Like if this quarter another three or four corporates come out and say, right, we're going on our balance sheet with Bitcoin, and then next quarter another five or six, and then the quarter after that another five or six, it's done, game over. You can't, like, if you then shut down Bitcoin, you crash your own stock market. So you're incentivized to protect it from attack from other governments or other central banks. It's mind-blowing, and this is why we're all here, because this space just gets us thinking to these nth degrees on either side of the spectrum, and it's so intellectually stimulating. So I wish I had a definitive answer for you guys. I don't think the US dollar dies anytime soon. I don't think the sterling dies anytime soon. I think there's a great opportunity for smaller European nations to get themselves out of a grip that they've been into for the last 20 years. Namely countries like Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, and many others, the smaller Eastern Bloc countries that might be on the wait list to get in the euro of all, like they've held the euro up on this pedestal and are on the wait list to try and get their seat at the table just by Bitcoin, right? Like, just put Bitcoin on the government balance sheet and attract all this talent that's out in the space looking for a Bitcoin-friendly jurisdiction so that they can go and live and build amazing companies and, be a service to society and build this next layer of financial systems that is so in need of an upgrade that you can't fight it. It's going to happen. So there's big opportunities for individual countries out there to really shine over the next couple of decades. And I just wonder when we get that announcement. Shimon, I'm going to give you some space.
No, I just love all these ideas that are coming up. One thing that I wanted to ask you, and I have a theory behind this, but really would love to understand your perspective. So historically, real estate and the stock market have been the things that people buy in order to protect themselves from the money printing. Like, people understood it kind of intuitively. And so we believe that Bitcoin is better. But why? Why specifically compared to the stock market? Why do you think Bitcoin is a better protection against the money printing than the stock market? And then I can tell you what I think.
Sure. And I think Alex just touched on this virtuous cycle of good behavior and good incentives. It's this pure network of, like, no one's controlling it. It's not a rigged game. Whereas the stock market is a completely rigged game. And a lot of people listening to this might find those comments inflammatory. But if you weren't watching what went on with Wall Street Bets a week and a half ago, and then Robinhood app shutting down any of their traders from being able to buy that GameStop stock, I mean, that's nothing more than market manipulation. And the huge hedge fund billionaire companies behind the app putting the pressure on this app. So they manipulated the market to stop that hurt, to stop this gang of individual retail investors. And that, if you, that's not the biggest red flag that you've ever seen in your life, that is a pure casino, then don't go to the casino. It's rigged in their favor. We all know that. If we go out to Vegas, we know the tables have the percentage chance in their favor. We know what we're walking into. What we've been led to believe with the stock market is it's down to our own skill and our own research. And we feel great when we go out to the dinner parties and have cocktails with our friends. And we say, yeah, I bought Tesla on the lows, and I bought Facebook on the IPO, and I bought Twitter, and, you know, just before it shot up to wherever. We think we're gods. We were just lucky. And we were nowhere near as big a winners as the pre-market stuff that was going on, like the big investors, that we're not even allowed to take part in because we're not accredited investors. Like, there's another whole point of, like, that game being rigged. You can't even get a seat at the table until it's gone to the casino. And by then, believe me, the money's already been made where it needs to be made. Sure, you'll make some if you're lucky and you choose the right stocks. There's no amount of research into an individual stock that you could do that isn't going to be unraveled by a flagrant comment from like a flamboyant CEO, like a la Elon Musk. You know, if somebody tomorrow decided at the SEC that, right, he needs to go down and he needs to be stripped of his title and probably go to prison, what's going to happen to Tesla stock? And this is what we call in the Bitcoin space as a central point of failure. And I now see any CEO as a central point of failure. So if you're going to invest in a company, or if you're going to invest in an altcoin, because all the altcoins have central points of failure, then be prepared for that day that you wake up to some bad news around that central point of failure, which is going to unravel all of the good work and all of the good research that you've ever done. Whereas with Bitcoin, there is this, yes, it's a mysterious story, and that pulls some people in, like Satoshi Nakamoto, and who is he, who is she, who is they. More importantly, we don't know, we don't ever need to know, and this is what is keeping this whole decentralized nature of this network so strong and growing stronger by the day, because there is no central point of failure and we don't have the trusted third parties. Well, you do if you're using the on-ramps and whatever else and you're not taking custody, but we can get into that as a different conversation. But that's my thoughts on it. So yeah, however you want to take that from there, Shimon.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And this gave me, I like to sometimes think like from very, very first principles and kind of ignore a little bit of the noise. But I have to say about the Wall Street Bets thing. So Alex and I did an episode about this and it just drives me crazy when people analyze an issue and they just stop at the surface level. So I heard a lot of the All In podcast with Chamath and Jason, you know, and they were talking about Wall Street Bets and they were talking about like Robinhood, and they're also investors in Robinhood. And then Chamath was investor in SoFi. So they kind of were attacking each other, whether Robinhood did the right thing or not. And the whole narrative was so stupid, in my opinion. It was like, oh, they were forced to do this because like this Clearinghouse Alliance suddenly calls them up in the middle of the night and says you have to post like $4 billion. Otherwise, like we're shutting you down completely. And they were like, okay, the only way we can like raise this money is if we stop the trading temporarily and, you know, raise the money and then everybody will be okay. And even Elon Musk on Clubhouse had like this conversation with Vlad, the CEO of Robinhood. And he was like, well, was there a gun to your head? Like, were you forced to do this or were you not forced to do this? And I'm like, this is completely the wrong conversation to have, because who cares if they were forced to do this? Like the hedge fund can like pick up a phone call, right? Pick up the phone and say, look, we're going to get short squeezed like crazy. We've already lost, what was it, like half a billion. I don't remember how much they lost. And they were like, okay, we have to force these like credit requirements. So who cares if they were forced or not? The question is who is pulling the strings? And to your point, Daniel, like, yeah, the stock market, there's so many people that can intervene and change the rules, intervene and change like the plan. You know, companies can have a strategic plan, but then something changes. And I think that's why Bitcoin is a much better kind of store of value than the stock market, because like it's very pure. You don't have to pay for salaries of people in companies. You don't have to make sure that the management makes the right decisions, right? Like if you think of the stock market, it's almost like, yes, it kind of protects you from inflation, you know, given the fact that people make really good business decisions and, you know, everything is working out as planned. And, you know, you have all of these assumptions that have to happen. And then, you know, if all of these happen, then the stock market protects you from inflation. But I think people will see that it's almost a much more pristine and clear vehicle for your value And then, yeah, more and more people will see it. And at the end, the proof is in the pudding. Like, I really didn't like this whole number go up technology meme, but now I kind of get it because that's the proof that it's better, right? Imagine now we have like 15 years or whatever, 12 years of track record. Imagine when Bitcoin has like 30 years of a track record of outperforming the stock market. That's it. That's all people need to know. Just look at the two lines. One goes up faster than the other.
Right. And yeah, there's another point here that people aren't giving too much attention to. And if you're new to the space and listening to this right now, I think here's a good example. For the last 3 days, the stock market has seen zero volatility. It's been flat because it's been closed. 72 hours. There was a public holiday yesterday. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is open every single minute of the day. And I think we're almost at the point, we might be a year away, I don't know exactly when I last checked it, that the total amount of trading time for Bitcoin is at the point of catching and overtaking the Dow. Like, you know, this in just 12 years. So what does that mean for people who want to, you know, especially big, like look at Wall Street, for example. This is all they do. They trade all day long. But for retail investors, if it's a Sunday afternoon and for whatever reason you need to access some money or liquidate some kind of funds, you don't have to wait until, you know, Monday morning opening hours or, you know, Tuesday morning because it was President's Day. And you don't also run that risk of, you know, some kind of random geopolitical event in the meantime, whilst you have to wait for the stock market to open, to place your order, to make sure that order goes through, and then to wait for that another half a day or day, whatever it is, for that to be actually converted back into your bank account. You know, these things people have got to, you know, look at a little bit closer. It's incredible. Like the whole thing, it's just redefining. As we said before, it's redefining. It's a financial system upgrade. Now, we upgrade our phones and computers all the time. We're used to upgrades. And this is all this is. We're upgrading the financial system, and it's going to be fairer to everybody. Bitcoin, it shines a light on you, right? It elevates the morally just and exposes the charlatans and the fraudsters. And it's such an amazing thing that it can do that. But the way it can do that is because it grounds you to this concept of sound money. It grounds you to this concept of what I am spending my time and energy doing to earn money is being frittered away recklessly by others who are in these positions of power to pull these levers and print this cash to devalue the money that I have already worked so hard to get, and ultimately to devalue my time, to devalue my existence. And when you can switch across to Bitcoin and watch that money work for you and go up in nominal value, it changes. It has a profound effect on your life, on your outlook on the future. It changes your spending habits. It changes your health habits. It changes your eating habits. It's incredible to think that something as basic and something that we've had a very, very shallow understanding of, money, can have on somebody's existence. So when you see these people coming out and slamming it the way they do, it's like, and to step back and think again from first principles, Shimon, it's like, what are they, why? You know, these are clearly smart guys. You know, if I can see it, they can see it. You know, there's only a couple of hours of podcasts you need to listen to, and you know, perhaps a book like Jan Pritzker's book. It's like 100 pages long, or Knut's book. That, you know, they're easy to digest, and Bitcoin is intuitive. So what's stopping them, and what's the pushback? And it's because they are plugged into the financial legacy system that's not getting this upgrade. If they just buy and hold Bitcoin, they'll be fine. Go ahead and retire, guys. You look pretty old, right? But why are you fighting this fight of this is all just, you know, rat poison, like Buffett calls it rat poison. You're like, come on. These are influential people. And if you think about the people that are reading these comments and following you and looking to you for advice, stop charging them for it. Like, you know, this subscription model that these guys run, this is their business. You know, these podcasts we do are for free. We're trying to educate people about Bitcoin. We're not charging anyone to do this. But the legacy financial system, these guys get paid a lot of money to manage your money, and generally not manage it that well, especially after you've paid the fees and commission and admin and whatever else that gets charged on top of it. So, and when, like, the other classic is Hedgeye, right? The guy Keith McCulloch at Hedgeye. I mean, he's
that was so epic.
That guy.
A tweet stamp, right? Stamp the tweet. And same thing with Davey Day Trader. It's so awesome. It's like they just like are like, ah, I'm out, and then it goes like 3x.
Yeah. Now Dave's at least Dave a lot of his stuff is comedy. And, you know, this is a platform for him to engage with people. But look at, like, the good side of Dave. You know, like, he went into bat hard for the people for Robin Hood, and he's trying to expose the criminality that was going on there. But these other guys, they're just pumping their bags. They know that, hey, hang on a minute. If somebody doesn't have to pay me $350 a year for a monthly newsletter that I pay someone, some virtual assistant, somewhere in the Far East to write up and send out to an email of 3,000 people and watch me talk shit and be disingenuous about other people and my guests on YouTube channel just for, just for clickbait. That's the legacy financial system we're trying to upgrade. That's what we want to get away from. These guys are...
Yeah. Absolutely. And one thing that's really painful to me is, so I'm in Silicon Valley. I live in San Francisco, and I've worked like in all these tech companies for like 10 years now. And what's crazy to me is like, yeah, you mentioned, for example, financial advisors, their resistance to Bitcoin is because then they will not make their fees. Then you have like people, for example, like in Silicon Valley, it's like a political thing. So I remember I was working at a startup right after BCG, and it was like a cryptography focused startup. It was something with cloud security. And we had some of the top cryptographers in the world, like Stanford professors on the advisory board. And everybody was super, super smart, right? Really smart people. They had no, they weren't financial advisors, right? So like they had nothing to lose from Bitcoin. And I remember that was like 2013, right? And we brought up the subject of Bitcoin. And all the smartest guys, they were like, no, this will never happen because just governments won't let it happen. Like, it's very simple, you know, like the governments, they defeated the Nazis. They have like aircraft carriers. Like, if they want to stop it, they can stop it. And very clearly, this hurts the government's ability to print money and give it to poor people. So like, that's it. End of story. And actually, that was the first time I heard about Bitcoin, and I never looked at it again until 2016. But like what drives me crazy is like, yeah, it's a purely political thing, right? You believe that the government should intervene, and it's clear that if Bitcoin succeeds, the government will have less degrees of freedom to intervene. And so that's why you dismiss it. And it's, my friend Dan Held, he had an episode recently, which was crazy. He basically said back in 2013, 2014, when he was like at Uber, basically supporting Bitcoin was career suicide. In Silicon Valley. Like if you would publicly start being very, very much pro Bitcoin, people just wouldn't hire you. And that's like so weird to me. Like you can have different reasons for dismissing it. And like, yeah, it could be political reasons. It could be like the fact that you're making money off the current system. ideological reasons. There's so many things. To be fair, I'm actually very happy with the American government's reaction to Bitcoin. I think the American government has a good kind of track record of figuring out where there's opportunity and not blocking it. Like some, I heard on some podcast that when the internet was just getting started, Europe was like, oh, let's make a government internet. And there was this committee that wanted to make like the internet better than just this open. I don't know if you guys remember in the beginning, it was just the Wild West in the internet. There was like all the illegal stuff, everything. And Europe just missed the train because of overregulation. So I really, yeah, it's sad to me because Silicon Valley is supposed to be a place of innovation. It's supposed to be a place that embraces change. But I even remember when I started working at Bitcoin here in San Francisco, I was head of growth for Kraken, and I got invited to this like fintech event, right? And you had all the Silicon Valley fintech people. And you would ask someone like, what are you doing? It's like, oh my God, we're changing the whole world of insurance. We're disrupting insurance. What we're doing is if you drive your car less than average, right? We have a way of knowing that. And then we give you cheaper like rates. I'm like, that's disrupting? That's like nothing. That's just like a small feature. Like, sure, great. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's a buzzword.
Yeah. But anyway, guys, this was great. I think it's a good place to wrap. So, Daniel, why don't you tell our listeners where can people find about you and your work and what are your kind of plans for the near future?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys. Alex, Shimon, brilliant to see a new podcast or new-ish podcast on the circuit. I've always pushed the Bitcoin Twitter lurkers out there to step up because we need as many people as possible to help push this thing over the line. And, you know, we're going to face a lot of influencers on the altcoin side. And that's one thing they need. They need influencers because they have to influence people. We have educators on our side. We need more educators. And that is a big difference. So if anybody is listening, please, if you've got something to write, if you've got something to say, if you've got a tune to play on TikTok or, you know, start a YouTube channel, whatever it is, you know, bring the noise because, you know, it will be well received and you'll help someone understand something about Bitcoin. My podcast is, the Once Bitten podcast. You can find that, pretty much everywhere. Wherever you listen to your podcasts. My website is once-bitten.com, and you'll be able to find out a little bit more about myself. There's a link to my book. I wrote a book called Choose Life, which was about escaping the rat race. My wife and I, we extricated ourselves from that financial career I talked to you guys about at the beginning of the show, and we took our four kids out of school. I quit my job. We sold everything and we went traveling. We traveled for 2.5 years with the kids, four kids. Yeah. Via the sharing economy, which was an amazing journey. And I wrote a book about how other people might be able to follow in our footsteps and, you know, the things that we put in place to make that a possibility. And I hope that that helps others. So, That's me, guys. Really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And I'll just say that the whole world schooling thing, Kate and I, my wife and I, we've listened to some of your podcasts. And yeah, we're very, very excited about having a little bit of a non-traditional way to raise our kids. But maybe we can chat about this next time you come on as a guest. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, anytime, guys, anytime.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Have a great, what are you guys? Afternoon.
I'm just getting started here in San Francisco. It's 9 in the morning.
Have a great day, man.